It works, but it is a thing of nightmares with non-Euclidean angles and too many mouths.
This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment. Later, Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Nels Anderson. Nels is a game designer and developer who is known for his critically acclaimed work on Mark of the Ninja and, most recently, Firewatch. Hi, Nels.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I am excellent.
Thank you for having me on your cool podcast.
Thanks for bringing it up. We're super excited to have a second Campo on the show.
And the Canadian... Well, actually, it's not true. You guys have locked down both the Canadians from Campo Santo on your show.
I didn't know Jane was Canadian.
Yeah, she's totally Canadian. She grew up in Hong Kong, but she moved over here to Vancouver when she was like 8 or 10.
A classic
or like
Vancouver
that.
Story.
Yeah, correct.
Cool. Yeah, I didn't realize that. Well, we're collecting them as some sort of trading card game, I think, is going to be the
You
new,
have
the new
caught
plan.
Them all.
Yeah.
Well, now, I mean, you can talk to the Americans if you want.
I guess. But. I mean, the lesser known Campos.
I don't really see the point.
Who does?
Awesome. So we have, I think it'll be a fun episode because we're going to obviously be digging into Firewatch now that it has been released, highly anticipated. So nominally, the topic is going to be making narrative-driven games, and obviously Firewatch is going to be a main part of that. And because it is such a narrative-based game that something is going to come up, we're going to want to be able to talk about it. And so there are going to be spoilers. But unlike many other things, you know, if there's Game of Thrones spoilers, you can't necessarily just go watch all of Game of Thrones. But with Firewatch, you can probably, depending what time it is right now, literally stop this show, go get Firewatch if for some reason you haven't already done it, play the entire game, and, you know, before the day is over, you could probably also listen to this show again because, you know, it's not an unreasonably short game, but it's one of those, you know, if you will probably get sucked into it and not go to bed until it's done, if you're anything like Nigel and I both, I think, did that. So
that's
yeah,
cool.
we both accidentally got sucked into playing the whole game on opening. And it was even like I've stayed up later playing video games. Like it wasn't even like I was up crazy late. It was like I was up until like 1 or something like that.
Right.
Playing it. Like
Well, yeah. That's good. I'm glad it was so gripping.
Yeah. It definitely with these sort of narrative games it feels good to just stay in the flow and in the sense of it. And so I was glad that I was able to do that, you know, and Journey and Gone Home and these sort of games are kind of all in that category. So it's nice.
Yeah. Once there's a bit of a momentum, it's easy to kind of see it through to the end.
Yeah, exactly. I got a few things that I think would make good topics and parts of this to dig into. But something that's been interesting to me, thinking about Firewatch from a game development perspective, obviously the narrative is, you know, a huge part of the sort of obvious part of the game. And then the visuals and the graphics are also like very obvious, sort of things that people talk about and things that show up in the discussion. But in order to bring those to life and make an actual game out of them, there's got to be a lot of, you know, systems and pieces and logic that go behind the scenes to actually make that all happen.
Is there ever?
You were actually doing something for the last year or two. So.
I was doing a lot of some things.
So what kind of pieces are there that when, you know, when you're spending your time building a game like this, when we're talking about, you know, gameplay programming and sort of game design, but the gamey parts of it, what does that look like? What is your day-to-day been for the last however many months?
Well, me specifically.
And the team in general, but when you're kind of that piece, you know, the piece that's under the surface of the story and the visuals.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, even at the most basic, obvious level, like Sean writes the good words what come out of people's mouths, but and then of course he goes off with Rich and Sissy and records said words, but then you just have a giant bucket full of MP3s. And they need to be in an interactive game somehow. So there's that, right? And that means, like, obviously there's building the understanding of, you know, oh, I'm looking at a specific thing, so the game needs to know what kind of thing I'm looking at, and then that needs to be clearly communicated to the person playing it, that I can talk about this. And that doesn't just happen magically. That, you know, there's all the implementation that goes into just even the simple, like, I mean, that stuff, like, you know, by the, like, we really knew how to, like, the first half of making Firewatch was just kind of figuring out how to make Firewatch, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, like, we didn't, you know, none of us had worked on a game exactly like this before, you know. Will, our gameplay programmer, Will Armstrong, he'd worked on BioShock 2, so he knew about, like, you know, making a first-person game with a lot of, like, really embodied first-person animation. And Sean and Jake had obviously worked on a narrative game like The Walking Dead, you know, and I'd worked on a game with a relatively high degree of player agency like Ninja, but none of us had worked on a game that was, like, exactly like Firewatch.
Well, there hasn't been a lot of games exactly like Firewatch, but it's kind of in a new sort of evolving genre too, which makes, you know, there's stuff to discover.
Yeah. But if, you know, if you'd made like an Assassin's Creed and then you were to go work on like an Arkham Asylum or whatever, you could be like, well, I kind of get what this is like. And we, for none of us had that direct overlap of what we'd done in the past. So kind of the first half of making Firewatch was just figuring out how the hell to actually make Firewatch. And then once we figured all that stuff out, then it was the actually making it, like, you know, getting all the stuff we wanted to be in the game. So that's all like the simple, you know, really mundane moment-to-moment interactions of, I look at a thing, the game tells me I potentially could radio about it or pick it up or throw it or use it on another thing or whatever. But then there's also like the more complicated encounters and conversations and moments and just the way the game transitions between different days and events in the games that happen. All of that stuff was primarily me. Jake did a bunch of that implementation as well. Chris did some. And there was a completely separate programmer, this rad dude who used to work at Twitter, actually, called Patrick Ewing. Not that Patrick Ewing, the one that used to work at Twitter. and he built this whole dialogue database system, you know, because if you've worked at a place that has been making games that have a, you know, an emphasis on dialogue and characters, like, you know, a BioWare or whatever, right? Like, they have this big in-house tool that they've been growing over, like, the past 5-6 years or whatever. Obviously, we didn't have anything like that. And just off the shelf, like, just being like, Unity, play.sound, MP3 file name.
And that works for a while, but when you get to, how many, we're talking, like, in the hundreds, definitely, like mid-hundreds number of different MP3s of pieces of dialogue?
Oh my god, are you kidding me? Like thousands. Maybe tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Jesus.
Maybe. Definitely.
Definitely more than 1,000.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you are closer to 10,000 than 1,000 side of lines of dialogue.
So if you just manually write the code of the branching, if you're in this location clicking on this thing, then do this MP3, unless you've already, you know, Dalila's already said that, in which case then pretty soon you have a bunch of spaghetti that is completely unmaintainable and will never be bug fixable and you will die.
Correct. I'm curious about how much of your prototyping, like, focused on that kind of narrative stuff versus the world exploration stuff. Like, I feel like for, you know, like big action games now, there's a pretty good handle on how to, you know, separate the gameplay and the art elements of things. For example, that you get a lot of, you know, first person shooters and stuff like that will go, and we know, okay, we like gray block the world and like build out the gameplay space with no textures and ornamentation. And then play that until you've got the gameplay style right, and then put the art in. But is that the approach you guys followed with the narrative? Like, did you build yourself like a little text adventure of the whole game first, and then start putting the visuals on it, or how much did the prototype of the 3D world tie into the process of prototyping the rest of the game?
Yeah, we definitely did not have the entire game written out before we started working. No, sir, we did not. we had the premise, like, you know, when we were talking to Panic and, you know, got them as our really, really impossibly cool funding partner, publisher, however you want to call them. Like, there was the premise of, you know, you're this dude named Henry, you're up in this fire lookout tower, The only person you have to talk to is this lady named Delilah. Although, I don't even think her name... I don't even know if his name was Henry, actually. You're a guy, and there's a lady you talk to on a radio. You're in a fire lookout, she's in a fire lookout. But that was kind of it. And so, when we started actually making real game for real, you know, we had... You know, we talked about at a very impossibly super high level, kind of where we wanted things to go. But the thing we actually started doing for real, like the first meaty chunk of game that we built, was what is now our primary Unity scene, Teen Loop. That is the scene that lives underneath all of our game is just called a teenloop.unity. Because the first thing we actually built is that, like, encounter with those asshole camper teens.
Right, the sort of, like, just after the beginning of the game when you arrive, your first mini mission.
Exactly.
And that's what the demo was at GDC and XOXO that I saw.
Yes, right. Yeah. So that was the first chunk of the game that was made. And because it kind of had, not everything, but, like, it had a good, it always sounds really, like, kind of just weird to say this, but it's kind of like a vertical slice where it had, like, all the main stuff that we knew the game was going to need. And in figuring out how to build that teen loop, that is kind of how we figured out then what we needed to build the rest of the game in terms of, like, tools and workflow and how... Because, you know, we were starting from, like, Unity... what was that at the time? God, we were still in Unity 4. When we started, like, 2 years ago, Unity 4, you know, 4.6 or whatever the hell it was, like, we just went file, new scene. And that was literally what we started with. So we had to build everything from there. We built this, primarily Will... built this event system that ultimately drives all of the dialogue. It was actually based on this, on the system that Valve used for Left 4 Dead. I forget the guy's name, but I think at GDC, like 3 or 4 years ago, one of Valve's programmers did like a really good, crunchy, in-depth talk about how the dialogue system works in Left 4 Dead. Because it's obviously way more procedural, but it kind of has the same level of like specificity where possible, right? Where it's like, you know, if it comes time to play some bark in Left 4 Dead, ideally it wants to look at the, you know, the facts, as you kind of call them, right? Like the data in the environment, like what characters are around, what condition are they in, what things did we just see, what items are we carrying, blah blah blah, blah, and try to deliver as specific a line of content as possible, because that's what makes Left 4 Dead feel like really reactive and interesting, right? You're not like always getting the same four barks of, you know, on the move, grenade out, whatever, like, you know, you talk about, oh my god, that clown almost got Coach or whatever.
You blew his head right off.
Yeah, so it's like,
and you can only use that when you blew someone's head right off, so you have to actually deal
exactly with that. And when you play Left 4 Dead, especially Left 4 Dead 2, like the amount of context in almost all the authored but procedurally triggered dialogue in Left 4 Dead is all really, really, really on point. So we built, obviously it doesn't have the procedural triggering, but we built a very similar system where, you know, when, like, the game, and it can be through actually like a volume collider trigger in the world, or it could be due to like a state machine or whatever, but you can say, okay, fire off, you know, like on radio beer can event, right? And then in this event system that we built, we have the ability to, like, okay, well, you know, okay, well, this particular handler for that event, it has like these five facts, and we always want to be as specific as possible. So if these five things are all true, we'll play this really specific line about this bit of litter. But then if one of those facts is inaccurate, is not, you know, doesn't resolve to true, then we'll drop down to probably a slightly more generic version of that, or just a different version if it, you know, there's just kind of a switch based on some fact previously that one of those two versions is always going to be true, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Right, but that's something that I hadn't, because when I was thinking about the sort of process of stringing together those pieces of dialogue, the experience I had was fairly straightforward in that in my mind, each thing follows from the previous thing, and you see the first beer can, you say there's a beer can here, and later you'll say I found another beer can. But if you don't interact with, or maybe don't notice the first beer can, that you can't say there's another beer can.
Exactly.
And that yes. actually makes it so that there's way more branching than it occurred to me than there was.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't forced to comment on the first beer can to continue.
Correct. Oh, yeah. And
that
and,
I mean, there's a whole bunch of callbacks that go even way farther back than that, right? Like, there's bits of dialogue in the end game that refer to, like, choices that you made, you know, I think in some cases in like, the opening text-only setup, right? Like,
yep.
that, you know, that's got to sort of hold on to those choices for the whole game.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, I mean, particularly given the ability to skip dialogue, you know, that you never, I mean, Henry never really has to say almost anything. Like, I'm sure there's some places that you're required to speak, but the vast majority of the conversations you can just ignore, right? In which case, Delilah has almost no information to go on what she's saying to you. I haven't entirely decided if I'm going to play through the game again, but if I do, I definitely, like, I said something almost every time I could my first time through, and I think I would definitely keep more information from Delilah.
Be laconic, Henry.
Through.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that, like, you know, in hindsight, retrospect, whatever, it sounds really obvious, but of course, like, as we were just building the game, like, we kind of had that realization, right, where it's like, oh, well, just because the player saw something, like, because they, you know, they put their reticle on an object, or they even picked it up, like, they didn't tell Delilah about it, she doesn't know about it. So, you know, unless, you know, there's some other reason where it's like, she can also see the fireworks or whatever. But generally, it's like, if you see and engage with a thing, unless you tell her about it, she has no idea. So she can't ever, like, you know, behave or speak in such a way as if she knew about the things unless you've actually told her about it. So it's like just another friggin' ball to keep up in the air when you're juggling all this stuff already, right? Probably the part of the game where this is the most just absolutely bonkers, and the all the, we call it wiring, but all of the event logic for this stuff is just it's just a blasted hellscape. It works, but it is a thing of nightmares with non-Euclidean angles and too many mouths. So on the 77th day of the game, that's the morning where you wake up. You know, all of a sudden she's all chipper and she's like, so you should just go take a midday hike to this place, maybe.
Right. And this is like the morning after you find the fence, but you haven't gone into the station yet.
Yeah. And she wants you to go to Cottonwood.
Yeah, exactly. The morning after the crazy weird day where things seem crazy. So ostensibly everybody hikes out to that cash box where she left a radio. You swap out your radio for this new radio. And then she goes, oh my God, Henry, what's going on? But the thing is, you know, you don't have to do that, right? Like, you have the Pulaski, you can just walk over to the research station gate and just open the gate and just go in there and start talking about all the shit that's in there. And so, you know, and Sean, there's a interesting interview on IGN that it was Chris, Jake, Sean, and Jane. And if folks are interested, they should talk about that because they talk about a bunch of other stuff that I'm sure we won't cover today. But, you know, that is kind of that encounter, right, where it's like you can technically just completely ignore what she's saying and go do something else. Like in an old school adventure game, like the character would just kind of monologue to himself, be like, oh, I should really go where she's telling me or whatever, right? There'd just be some like totally, like, non-diegetic, just the game won't progress until you do the thing it's telling you to do. But that's not the kind of game we wanted to make. So we just support, like, you don't ever go get that new radio. You just walk straight into the research site, into Wapiti Station. And as soon as you get there, you know, Henry, like, the first thing you radio about, and this is, again, where the event system has to know, like, the first thing you radio about, regardless of what the hell it is, it has to route into this first line of dialogue where he's like, you know, I'm here at the site and there's this crazy, like, antenna tower. And she just goes, Henry, you should go where I told you to go. There's something important there. And then if you just completely blow her off and do that three more times, she just kind of throws up her hands and goes, okay, fine. And then you can talk about all the stuff there, but all her lines are different. She's way more terse and kind of pissed off, right?
Wow, that's a lot of work.
It sure was.
And then you'll see what percentage of, I don't know if you keep analytics, what percentage of people see that. But
we do not, but I have not heard a single person talk about that. I'm sure someone has just tried it just to see what has happened, but I have not heard a single person comment upon that. In the amount of hours of human life spent making all of that stuff work are not small.
See, that's interesting, because I definitely assumed that just for practical, this is this indie team purposes, that there was a few of those things that just had to be cut off by, I would go up and I would go to take the gate down with the axe, and he would be like, I really should go to Cottonwood first. Like, you just say it. But is there any of that dialogue where he just says something to himself to, like, indicate to the player, like, that he kind of refuses to do something? I don't know.
There is one time that I got, maybe it wasn't a line of dialogue, though. There was one time that I got invisible walled on something of, like, it wouldn't let me go down one of the, repelling down sections before I went and did something.
There is one spot where we just, like, could not come up with anything for this exact same reason. Like, all the worst stuff, not worst, but, like, the most challenging stuff to deal with when building Firewatch, hands down, was all the stuff where, like, you know, we never wanted to do that goofy adventure, like, old school adventure game, like, monologue, but the game is basically telling you can't do this thing, right? But given that the structure of the game is kind of this Metroidvania, as soon as, you know, you get your appropriate locomotion items, you can just kind of go wherever you want. And, you know, all the hoops we would have to jump through to give you appropriate items to only do appropriate gating. The only place where we couldn't come up with anything more elegant is at the very beginning of day 76, after all those really short, like, we called it the montage, but after all those really short time jump days, right? The very first time you go down, you're, like, supposed to go find bear tracks down by the lake.
Oh, yeah, right.
You find that weird clipboard. Yes. And, like, we spent so many hours trying to come up with some, because, like, that's the fundamental question, right? Like, we designed this scenario of this really cool, interesting thing, but then it's like, what if the player just doesn't go down to the lake? What if they just turn around and walk in the complete opposite direction? And it's like, okay, well, that's kind of fine. They'll get down there eventually. It's like, yeah, but what if they just walk to the scout camp? And what if they just pull that Pulaski out of the tree? And then just what if they go to the research site from there? Yeah, because
at that point, the scout camp's open at that point, right? Like, it's blocked off in the early game, but it's open on that day. And I think, I can't remember, I think what I had done is I had not opened a bunch of the caches.
Right.
Like, I'd only opened, like, the one cache that you had to open earlier in the game or something like that, or maybe I'd open like one other, and I was like, oh, I really should go and collect the other caches. And so I went and tried to do that and ran into the wouldn't let me rappel down.
That was just the one spot where it's like, any kind of solution we could come up with, this is like, it wouldn't demonstratively make the game better. It would probably end up confusing some people. And it's just, given our limited amount of time, it's like, that's just, this is the one time we're just going to do it. We're just going to deal with it. We're going to do it. It is just like, yeah, it's just like there are only three of basically the things that let you get back from the lake up to kind of the main hub areas. It's just kind of like, just chill out for a second.
It's interesting because
that is the one time we cheated it.
Even though it's a thing of like, okay, we only have so much resources, we're a small team, we need to deal with this, it doesn't actually, like, those sort of trade-offs, regardless of how small or large your team it is, you eventually get down into the weeds where, okay, 1% of people are going to encounter this and how much work will it be? 0.1% of people will encounter this and how much work will it be? And so you eventually start getting to this point where
one dude ever.
Yeah, exactly. And so you eventually get to a point where, you know, having a few of those sort of disappointing philosophically but practical trade-offs where, well, if we spend 40 less hours not making some side thing that happens if you go trying to clear this brush in the back corner way off whatever. And instead, we take those 40 hours and spend them on some other thing, then the average experience in the game is going to be better, as long as you don't compromise the whole idea of the game and force them onto a single track.
I think there's also, you know, there's an interesting thing there with that particular one, or those, actually both of those kind of working together, is like, you know, you can't always impart the correct sense of urgency to the player if you're trying to surprise them, right? Like, the thing about that moment in particular, I think why, like, it never even occurred to me to not go and get the radio, right? Because, like, you know, at that point I was in, like, super tense, like, what the hell's going on mode, and, like, Delilah's acting really weird. I'm like, okay, I gotta go get this radio, because that's, you know, like, there's a lot of, it, you know, it's obvious that that's the way forward, right? That that's what's supposed to be happening at this point. And as a player, I wanted to do that stuff. Whereas the problem with that on, I think why I ran into the invisible wall on day 76 is because that was set up as much more casual, right? It's like, oh, okay, you know, you're going to go and look around and, like, maybe check for this bear while you're down at the lake. And, like, from the standpoint of you guys making the narrative, it's important because, like, a really key inciting incident happens down at the lake, but you don't want to tell the player that in advance in that case, right? Like, the whole point of that moment is to be surprised by, like, discovering the clipboard and getting attacked and all those things, right? So you can't tell the player, oh yeah, you got to get to the lake. It's really important. Like, get down there right now. Like, it's super urgent. You've got to just, you want to kind of go into that with that casual, like, you know, whatever. And so in my case, I took that casual, you know, whatever, and was like, hey, maybe now's a good time to go and collect up all those, like, caches that I haven't got so far.
Right. It also is like, why is there this weird invisible thing telling me to go look for a bear? Yeah, I mean, and that bit was especially meant to be surprising because at that point in the game, you know, you'd gone through all these time jumps. And so, like, the feeling we wanted to impart was, when someone sees that fishing rod thing, it's like, oh, maybe this is going to be just another one of these little short vignette type moments where I just walk down to the lake, I, like, cast the rod in, and then cut to the next day. And we wanted it to feel that way, so obviously we, as you correctly identified, we couldn't, like, telegraph too hard that, like, oh, this is when an important thing is about to happen, right?
It was a great misdirect with the, like, okay, I understand what's happening here, I'm going to go check for bear traps. Or bear tracks, I'm going to see bear tracks, and then be like, well, I'm sure there won't be a bear, and then it cuts to when we actually encounter the bear later, right? Like, I was just, brain expectation went way off onto this different track, and so I was quite, like, even to the point where a couple days later, I'm like, okay, there's this guy, and there's also a bear.
the interesting thing about that, though, is that's another case of kind of, I wasn't really worried about the bear, not for any good in-game reason, but more because I'm like, they didn't have the budget to do a bear. Are you kidding me? There's not going to be a bear down there.
Whereas it occurred to me is like, I know they wouldn't, like, also thinking from a game developer perspective, I knew I wouldn't meet Delilah because they wouldn't have the budget for me to meet Delilah. But I felt like, oh, they might be able to do a bear. But what I knew they wouldn't probably do is make it easy for me to just die in the game to end.
Right.
Like, that was my sort of game developer sense of not being afraid of the bear, because I had already to that point gotten to the sense of this is the type of game that's not going to make me fall into a hole and then like retry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting problem that narrative focused games have that more gameplay focused ones don't. Is in a gameplay focused game, you kind of want the player to be, you know, acting a little bit like they have a copy of the script and they know where they're going, because you don't want them to be blocked and frustrated. And so if everything's, like, super cliche and all the moves are really obviously telegraphed, like, it doesn't matter as much because that's not what people are there for. But in a narrative focused game, you don't want to do that, right? Like, you want to not have people saying, like, oh, something important must be happening because somewhere that I can usually go is invisible walled off and it's forcing me to one place, or they're like, oh, I doubt there's actually going to be a bear there because I don't think that this game would put you in a situation where you could actually die. Like, those are, in lots of games, those are good things to occur to the player, but it just isn't here. It's a real, you know, it's a real tricky challenge.
Yeah, it is definitely not simple. Like, just this whole giant subset of kind of ways that you can create, you know, moments. When you don't have a game with any notion of failure, and thus without any notion of skill, all that stuff, and by failure, I mean like relatively light failure, right? Like, you know, obviously you can have skill playing a puzzle game where failure is just you're stuck until you solve the puzzle, but minor variant on the same thing. But when you don't have any of that, your ability to affect the player changes and shrinks a whole lot.
A lot of the things that we're used to thinking about in game design. Well, we'll make it so if they don't do this, they'll run out of resources and eventually be punished in this way and then die, you know. And there's yep. We don't have all these levers. But there's
and
also
none of that exists.
There's also some interesting evidence of the sort of exploration of, okay, well, how can the player affect the world or and vice versa, you know, outside of that scope that I think, you know, is a thing that in this, you know, if we're calling it a genre, I'm not sure if I don't have a name for the genre. Other, I mean, narrative driven games is something that's been around for a long time. There's a Steam tag called Walking Simulator, which is like was originally this pejorative people would give to like Gone Home, but then people have sort of embraced it and then yeah. sort of transcending that.
I mean, I still find it kind of pejorative.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously was originally intended as pejorative, but then it's sort of like as the genre. I mean, obviously, Firewatch is, you know, goes way well beyond walking as the ways that you interact with the world.
Hiking simulator, please.
Yeah, at the minimum. Yeah.
Someone on our Steam forums quipped about a walkie-talkie simulator, and I did like that one.
Well, that's getting closer. But I was going to say the one, or not the one, but one of the little bits that I saw is like, oh, that was like a big win for, oh, maybe it was a bunch of work, but it felt to me like maybe a big win was this thing where Delilah asks you to name the fire. And I named it the Flapjack Fire. And anytime I saw the Flapjack Fire, yes. I was like, ah, oh, I named that. And it's like this big fire in the world. And it just like programmatically is the same fire. But whenever you look at it, it says the Flapjack Fire. I was just like, yeah, I did that. And like I had this weird pride over naming it.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of those little moments. There's the thing with like the drawing of, well, actually it's both drawings of Henry, right? Like the drawing that Julie, right? That's his wife's name?
Julia.
Has done that he has, and then also the one that Delilah does based on his description that you see at the end are both that same way, right?
Yep.
Of like, you make a narrative choice at some point that seem, you know, that's not really responded to in any way at the time, but then later on you get something different depending on what you've chosen there.
Yeah, and just in general, like, there's still satisfaction, I think, like a relatively primal satisfaction just in, you know, putting input into a system and seeing the output, right? And then when that's deferred, then that can be like a very pleasantly surprising moment where, you know, often, like I think, especially for people who are a little bit more like, you know, accustomed to the form, like they kind of like, oh, okay, this is a scripted sequence. I know how this is going to go. And then they don't expect anything to be different, right? Like, they don't expect there to be moments where a thing could have been different because they just assume that it's like, this is always play out the same for everybody. Because that's how games are made, right? And then in those moments where it does have a chance, where, you know, you can take the chance to be surprising based on something they did and maybe even forgot about and didn't realize that they were, you know, actively seeding input into the system. Those moments, I think, are always very surprising and cool. And I like that a lot. And a lot of the smallest little things in Firewatch, a lot of those are examples of that.
Is there any particular part of sort of feedback or callbacks that you enjoyed or thought were particularly fun or interesting? I mean, obviously, the fun of something once you've, you know, been banging on for a long time becomes a different type of fun. But
no, I mean, I still love that drawing at the end where, like, that was a thing that we kind of quipped about for, you know, like when Sean like had the idea for on day three. She's talking about like, oh, I'm drawing you, whatever. And we kind of like in a very hand wavy, like, okay, yeah, sure. We'll make, yeah, like we'll put it in the actual drawing based on what you said. And then like Ollie and I ran the numbers. We're like, wait a minute. You make a choice out of four things and then a choice out of four things and then a choice out of three things and a choice out of three things. It's like, that's not that much. That's like 30 things. And we're like, wait a minute. No, that's not how math works. That's like 16,000 different permutations. Maybe we'll figure that out later. And then we didn't figure it out. We just didn't come back to it for such a long time. And then seriously, like a week, probably like a week before the game was going into cert, Ollie and Jake were talking, and basically Ollie fired over just this crazy layered PSD. Because of course, you know, like Unity has a UI system, but and UI can handle a bunch of transparency things. That's how the interface is almost always built. But getting that on Artifact in the world that you can actually pick up and move around is hard. Unity doesn't like to do that. So what actually ended up, the implementation of that was there is just a giant screen space UI canvas that is that drawing, that weird composite drawing with, you know, just a bunch of layer, like alphas, alpha layers turned on and off as appropriate for that drawing based on the decisions you made, just like way the hell off in the corner of the world where you can't see it. And then that gets rendered to a special camera and then rendered to a texture that is the actual drawing that's in her tower. Nice. But because Unity can't handle doing two rendered to textures at once, and the map is also one of those, when you get to Delilah's tower, we have to blow away the map and then use all the resources allocated for that for this goofy-ass drawing that's up on the wall instead. That's okay, because at the end of the game, the map isn't anywhere anyway. You're just in a no-man's land that's off the
map. So if you try to bring up the map at that point, nothing happens? Or
yeah, it just shouldn't work. Yeah,
and no one notices because you have nowhere to navigate to, probably.
Exactly, because you're there anyway, and Thoroughfare Lookout isn't even on the map that you've got, so whatever, it's fine. But yeah, that is definitely one of my favorite things, just because like at the very last minute we put that in, and you know it is like there's an option for all the choices, but there are a couple like extra special things in there where you know if you tell Delilah that you always wear tuxedos and that you've got like this thin mustache and a scar. She makes this quip.
Yeah, that's what I did. I went with a thin mustache and yeah. Scar for mine.
Yeah, and then if you also told her that you like to wear tuxedos exclusively, and she in just offhandedly makes some quips, like she's like, what, are you a Bond villain? But then the drawing at the end for those two combination of things specifically has you drawn way more looking like, you know, just a gross, weird, like Scaramanga type Bond villain. There's a couple things like that where if you tell her that you look like Burt Reynolds and then you also name your turtle Turt Reynolds on the drawing, there's like a little heart with Burt plus Turt inside of it.
This is a lot of stuff for a week before certification.
we like to bring stuff in hot. What can I say? Yeah, it's the kind of thing where it's like not only are you actually actively making dialogue choices and you get to have this reflected like way, way at the end of the game, but there's also even some things inside of that which are even more specific. That is kind of the most intense version of that in the whole game. But anytime there's a small thing like that, it always makes me very, very happy.
That's awesome. I didn't, not surprisingly, probably encounter this on my own pass through. But my understanding is that there is an alternative ending, sort of.
Kind of. I mean, like, when you even say that, it kind of like makes it sound like a Mass Effect ending or something, right?
I did call it an alternative ending, sort of.
Yeah. Okay. Emphasis on the sort of, like asterisks and bold. But it's the same kind of thing where, you know, kind of the given that the game we were making, we wanted to try to avoid any like really non-diegetic, like I was saying earlier, like big, like the game just saying you can't do that type moments, right? So there's a lot of player agency. So often we just be stymied by, it's like, well, what if the player doesn't, right? And it's like, well, okay, what's going to happen is the player is going to go down here and do this, whatever. It's like, yeah, but what if they don't? And unlike, you know, an action adventure game where it's like, oh, the game will just kind of idle until you keep going and you stop having fun. So you're just going to keep going because you're going to keep having fun, like, because, you know, the presentation we wanted to have was less abstract, right? Like when you really see those moments in a game that otherwise tries not to have those, it feels even more artificial, right? Like that's the moment when the curtain comes down and you see it's just like a weird little leprechaun guy with a big horn. So at the very, very, very end of the game, that, you know, the Wildland Firefighters helicopter shows up to pull you out. And if you're just like a total goddamn weirdo And you just like sit there and stare at them for, I forget how long it is. It's maybe,
I think it's 2 minutes.
It might be 2 minutes, like 2-3 minutes, something like that. I forget what the exact number is. Eventually they're just like, okay, weird guy, we're just going to take off. And they just leave, and then it just goes to the credits.
And that's the end. And you're not missing any game, so
yeah,
you know, you can
do
that.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing where it's like, okay, well, we can kind of do that because we're going to credits either way. But it's the sort of thing where it's like, if someone decides to be a total weirdo, the game will still be like, all right, weirdo, well, if you wanted to be that weirdo, you can be. Like, you, it's not just if you sit up in the tower. Like, you actually have to come out of the tower, go down, get really close to the helicopter, like, look that firefighter in the eye, and then just be like, I'm going to go over here and just hang out in the outhouse for a while. If you do that, then the game's just like, okay, well, goodbye.
Which is great.
Yeah. So it's the same kind of thing, right? Where that, again, just arose out of, you know, us being like, having some cool, interesting scenario, and then kind of later realizing, well, what if the player doesn't
What
do
if the
that
player doesn't get on the helicopter?
Thing we imagined. Well, the game should do something. It may not have to do the most amazing, equally impressive, cool thing, but it should do something. And then, you know, maybe for a few folks out there, they'll be very pleasantly surprised, or at least surprised when the game acknowledges and reacts to that.
Well, another thing on the ending that I thought was really interesting is I saw Jane, I'm pretty sure it was Jane, said that it was like substantially through development that you were playing through the game and realized that you needed to make some really major changes to like the end sequence of the story. How did that go? If you're
interested less,
in talking about it.
Yeah, it was less that ending sequence exactly, and it was more kind of the last third of the game plot-wise. Where it's not, like, the actual events happen, they're still the same, but for a long time, and there's, like, kind of the vestige of this in the game still, but it's like, a relatively lightweight, almost, like, throwaway thing now, where at the beginning of Day 78, after you had the weird, all the crazy stuff at Wapiti Station, and you found those keys on that weird backpack, at the very beginning of 78, you know, Delilah calls you up, and she's like, someone called claiming that they were Henry and Two Forks had told them that I was the one who started the Sight Fighter.
Oh, yeah. What was the deal with that?
Yeah. So initially, at that point, she totally thought that you had just been doing all this crazy stuff. Because, like, she doesn't know that you didn't burn the research station down. So at that point, initially, she was way more pissed and just kind of like, was super wary in distance and just was way more hesitant about engaging with you at all, which turned out to not be good.
Turned out not to be super fun when your only contact is mad at you.
Yeah.
And suspicious of you.
Yeah, and it's like this person in their relationship and it all just like, yeah, it's a thing that like on paper sounds good because it's like, oh, it's very grand and dramatic. But in practice, it was actually just like, kind of a downer, and not in like an interesting way, just in kind of like a this is not the best sort of way.
Right, that totally makes sense. So then that's the origin of why does Ned have notes about her that Henry wouldn't know?
Yeah.
And that proves to her that, oh, there is someone out there who is doing shit. It's not just Henry. Okay, now we're definitely on the same team.
Yeah, yeah. And then as part of that, we ended up like before, not entirely because of this, but not unrelated. All the thing with Brian and Ned, all that stuff originally was seeded way, way, way more lightly, to the point where, oh God, what was it? It was, okay, so initially, again, this was kind of one of those moments that's cool on paper, but just produces so many "what if the player doesn't" or "what if the player does" moments. It was just like the worst thing to deal with. But a lot of the papers and notes and stuff that are in Brian's like little hideaway fort thing, a lot of those were in that peachy folder, but they were in basically like stuck under a drawer inside of Two Forks. So at almost any point in the game, you could open that drawer and like jiggle it a couple times, and then this folder would fall out of the bottom, and then you could open all this stuff up and be like, there's all this weird science homework in here and like some nerd crap. Who's Brian Goodwin?
I wondered about the drawer.
It was a weird drawer.
Weird drawer.
Like, why is this drawer lighting up, but I can never open it?
No, there's an openable drawer that also seems to have more time and attention.
another like trying to play the game designer as opposed to playing the game thing. There's got to be like every time I'm like checking the drawer, I'm like, this drawer, why is it telling me about this drawer if I can't do anything with it?
No, you can definitely open it, because in there is like the only vestige of that remained was a map of the area, but it's all drawn up like a crazy D&D campaign. And hilariously, the character sheet, this is a good, completely unrelated tidbit, the character sheet in Brian's hideout of Gladius Silva, that is actually my first D&D character ever.
Nice.
From when I was, you know, in like grade 8 or whatever.
That's amazing.
And I made some offhanded quip about that, and everyone in the office thought it was so hilarious that they're like, well, no, just, I'm like, I'll go try to find my old sheet and scan it. Anyway, so you can find that folder with all of Brian's stuff at like any point from like day zero until, but then of course we got in a situation where it's like, okay, well at some point Henry has to find it. So he came up with this crazy convoluted thing at the beginning of day 78 where you had the keys to the cave on top of your desk, and then Henry would reach for them but kind of like knock them off his desk, so then he would crawl, it's just this one giant ass animation, he'd crawl underneath the desk, grab the keys, but bang his head coming out from underneath the desk, so the folder would fall down, so then he'd look at it, but even that didn't really help, because it'd just be like, well, player might just not radio about the stuff in this folder. So then the name Brian Goodwin still never comes up.
The backpack was the solution.
Yeah, so stitching the name on the backpack happened after all that word, just like, oh my God, you know, you could never hear the name Brian Goodwin until you find this weird body in the cave. But if you never brought it up, maybe Henry doesn't even have any idea who this kid is. And like at that point, Delilah's kind of alienated from you. So it's, she's just like, oh my God, what's happening? I got to get out of here. So at that point, we're like, you know, we can support as much kind of player agency as we want, but sometimes we also just need to make smart decisions that don't create a bad, insane game.
Yeah, is the Brian Goodwin on the backpack thing something that you have to radio about, like to get that dialogue snippet then, or can you ignore it? Because I feel like it was just a regular radio, which if true is kind of interesting.
Like, it is not. It plays automatically.
That's one of those things that I think is kind of neat about that structure is that, I mean, this is something I really quite enjoyed about the game in general was the whole structure of the radio and like the time aspect of it, giving you the hints and the option to say nothing and all that, is that you can actually kind of hide some of that important stuff in that noise without people noticing, right? Like it never occurred to me at the time that happened, that moment was any more important than, say, you know, like any of the stuff about the teens going missing or any of that, right?
Right.
Like, it, you know, you slip the real information in there with the red herrings, but if it's done clever enough, you can, you know, it's like a card force and magic or something, right? Like that, right? Like you force them to hear that bit of dialogue, but they feel like it's just something they picked, because until you said it just now, it never occurred to me that bit of information was not given to me by me purposefully asking about it as the player.
Yeah, that's one of those things where if we use, like, because we do it so sparingly, we kind of build up a little bit of credit or concealment, so that on those situations where it's just like the crazy weird apparatus of support we'd need to build in to make this thing work is just too crazy, so we'll just have Henry say something automatically. Since we do it really infrequently, it's good to hear that it does feel relatively seamless.
It was totally seamless. Like, that moment felt totally natural when it happened, especially because the way that the voice acting was quite good on it, it wasn't just like, Brian Goodwin, huh? Like, it was a few back and forth. I found the book backpack, and it's like, oh, there's rope in it, and he's using the rope, and she's like, well, that's good. And he's like, yeah, thanks, Brian Goodwin. And she's like, who? And then it's sort of like, it's down into the dialogue, and just felt totally seamless, because I played the game, and then a couple days later, in prep for the show, I watched a Let's Play, and the second time, I still didn't notice that it was
forced. So, yes. Yeah, I mean, I think it helps that, like, generally the times we do that are the times when the thing you're encountering is so interesting that it's like you as the player would almost certainly have wanted to talk about that. And even if you as the player might not have, Henry is so interested in it that it just feels natural to do. It was the kind of thing where it's like, you know, if he was like commenting on some, like the dampness of some river as he was walking across, and then that sags into this weird, crazy conversation that leads back to some part of Delilah's backstory that's vital down the road. It's like, that would feel really artificial. But I think we do it infrequently enough and in specific enough places where it feels like there's an interesting thing going on that, yeah, hopefully that those smoke and mirrors are intact.
The other verb in the game that is interesting to me as far as like making it work was this business of picking up and putting things down, which can actually trigger stuff. And I thought it was interesting because, you know, dealing with Unity and all this sort of stuff, you don't necessarily have, you know, this arbitrary set of animations and things like that. You just kind of like, okay, there's a thing you can, you know, so many objects in the world that you can pick up and you can rotate them and then you can aim and then you can press X or if you're on PC, whatever it is to put back down. And then you just kind of have to decide, what did they mean by that? Is like nicely put the thing back on the table or is it throw it in the lake or whatever? was that a thing that took a bunch of work or did it just kind of fall out of what you were given as far as those tools?
Yeah, well, once we had object interaction, that the actual putbackness of it was not that hard. I mean, that as a concept, of course, was like 100% lifted from Gone Home, because that is the that is the if there's one like mechanical contribution that Gone Home has made to first person games, it is the putback for sure. Yeah, so it's like once we have some notions, it's like okay, well, objects are going to have the spawn point where they're at. You know, it's like once you pick them up, well, you could just hypothetically click on that point again, and then we'll just restore them to that point. But then it's like, oh, but hypothetically, we could have like several of those valid place for an object to go points, and then it's just the object happens to be spawned in one, or maybe even not. Maybe it's just actually where it gets spawned is just like some cluttery version somewhere else, but then you can pick it up and like put it nicely back in a spot where it's supposed to go. That's one of those things that it feels like the game is, you know, is listening to the player's intent. Because if, like, that was always kind of the bummer, right? Where, you know, in, especially in, like, just the vanilla version of Skyrim, where it's like, oh, you got this cool house and you want to decorate it. It's like, yeah, but all you can really do is just kind of, like, physics barf objects all over the place. And it just looks like a hoarder's hovel, right?
Yes.
So the fact that like when the game, it always feels very satisfying when you're like, I would like to put this in a nice spot, and the game goes, oh well, good, I can do that. Yes, I have heard you, and I will take this thing and put it in this nice place where you wanted it to go.
It's interesting to hear that because my wife actually was watching me play and she stayed up way past her bedtime wanting to see the ending. But not having played as many games, and especially not for first-person games, she thought it was very funny whenever I would pick something up and kind of look at it thoughtfully and then accidentally toss it on the ground.
Right.
And she's like, oh, the game doesn't know you're trying to put it back? I'm like, no, it's actually quite impressive that it often does know. It's just that you need to aim higher or lower. I don't remember. I quickly learned that I need to aim higher or lower to compensate, and then I was able to consistently put things back. But she didn't pick up that it was, you know, not reading my mind successfully, and whereas I was impressed with the fact that it did read my mind
often. Yeah, because so many things just don't at all, and your only option is sloppy physics toss.
Yeah.
There's actually one of my favorite, and this thing I will not spoil because it's very small, but one of my favorite things in the entire game has to do with a particular putback that I don't know if anyone has found. I don't know if anyone will ever find. But it's one of those quiet things that Jane just kind of offhandedly mentioned, and it was definitely, oh man, yeah, okay, we should do that.
And this is like a putting something not where you found it type thing.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That obviously is a giant, vast universe of things that could be, and you know, it could take a long time to find them, but you could imagine some pretty interesting extra either pieces of dialogue or whatever you could hide in those types of moments. That's cool.
Yeah, that's one of those things where, you know, if you have a game that doesn't have, like, you know, the ability to put input and receive output in the game in terms of, like, skill and failure and challenge and all that, then it's kind of like, this is one of those avenues where you still can have that. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, there's definitely, Partially just because, you know, so much of the environment in Firewatch is a natural one that, like, there's just less man-made stuff. But as a system, it's certainly a thing that is interesting and I think has a lot of potential for other people to poke at and explore for sure.
The only other thing that I wanted to definitely bring up, because I think it's sort of interesting or at least amusing, and it's a fairly visual one, so I'll put some links in the show notes, but it's this business of modeling the first-person character's body and what you need to do in order for that to actually make sense, look appropriate for the camera.
Yep.
Right? Because if Henry's hand is taking up like a quarter of the screen... He has some unusual anatomy.
Oh, yeah. The answer is you create a horror show nightmare. That is what you do. And it isn't just us. Like, there was a GIF I loved where it was pulled the camera in crisis from first person out to third person. And is the, you know, the dude was behind cover and then popping over cover to shoot and then ducking back down. His legs didn't move. They just stayed crouched the entire time. It's just his torso just turned into like this horrible like rubber snake.
I'm watching it right now.
Yeah, you found it. To flop like the top of his half over this concrete barrier and then slurp it back down. And it is just the most disgusting thing. And that is what all first person animation looks like.
Because why actually do a real animation? There's no reason.
Yeah,
and there's a mirror
Shitty. I guarantee you the reason why they did that is like probably the thing that was more naturally for the animator to think about doing is like, oh yeah, I'll just do this externally. But then actually cramming that into a first person camera, it looks insane and probably doesn't play well because it's like it's either slow or really snappy and it doesn't read. So instead you just have like horrible fucking slime worm. Well,
particularly in the case of cover mechanics, like you wouldn't want the position that you end up in cover to be dictated by some pre-recorded animation. You know, that's always a big issue in those kind of animation driven games. Like sports games have that same problem to a huge degree, right? Of like, you know, this guy's going to dunk the basketball, but you want to dunk the basketball when the gameplay says to dunk the basketball, not necessarily when, you know, when his hands reach the rim of the basket during the animation. But you also don't want to look at, you know, to look like complete, like, oh, his hands were 4 feet away from the basket, then all of a sudden the ball was in there. So you have
and he had 7 frames of a really fast lerp, and then boom.
and that's one of those things probably that would happen with that Crisis one, is that if you made the animation look good, then there'd be like those, you know, couple of pieces of cover in the game that like you'd poke out behind the cover and, oh, wait, I'm still completely behind the cover because the animation has not moved me to the correct location.
Our animator, James Benson, one, he's goddamn incredible. But two, it's just periodically he would just upload a GIF to the Campo Slack and just be like, here's what this animation looks like today. It was never good.
And I think there's also a factor there of, you know, it's one of those things that's just epidemic in game development of do it the way that's easiest to tune, right? Like, I'm sure if you really wanted to say, like, okay, let's try and, like, get the perspective and get the camera position and, like, you know, have everything look, you know, everything sort of lined up perfectly between both how the camera's done and the character's done, you could get something that looks a lot more realistic, but then the animator can't just make it look good himself, right? If you just say, you know, here's the camera, make an animation that looks okay, then, you know, the animation artist does some crazy things and it looks okay from that perspective. And then you don't have to also have the camera programmer spending a couple of days tweaking things to, you know, to make the animation look good. They just
let the animator do it themselves. Constraining how the camera can behave in a first person game is also really problematic because our ideas of, you know, the way that is realistic and just in practice what's realistic can be very different from what in practice is fun, right? Like, if you look at the where your head is would have to be in any cover mechanic, like, you're not undercover because you can see because physics, right? But in practice, you know, that's not going to make a very fun game.
Which is good in a shooter when you're trying to headshot, like, other people that are behind
you. Yeah, exactly, but not good when they can shoot you.
In those situations. I've been playing through the Uncharted remaster the last little while, and I'm very happy with the fact that the other people's heads come out of cover when I need to shoot them.
But your half-height traffic barricade completely obscures you.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Nels. This is awesome. How can people find out more about what you're up to and what the future holds?
Well, I don't even know what the future holds for us. We're still impossibly busy just dealing with a Firewatch.
I'm sure you have much Firewatch stuff to do, but how can people keep tabs on that or learn
more? I am probably the easiest thing to do is just hit me up on Twitter. That's Nels or Mensch, NelsorMensch. And future stuff for Firewatch plus whatever the heck we're eventually going to do some other day, many days from now, is just at Camposanto on Twitter, or I think just camposanto.com. Yeah, just camposanto.com. Either way.
Excellent. Well, everyone check that out, and I've got some links to some amusing animations of third-person Henry, as well as Crisis and some other things in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, dude, they're all gold.
They're always very fun. You can check that out and more at upup.fm. And see you next time. Doesn't that feel great to have shipped?
Mostly.
Well, the reviews have been great.
Yeah, no. The response is positive. I mean, it is probably, you know, maybe more positive. At least more people are checking out the game than we expected, which is really sweet. I mean, obviously, that's an incredible problem to have. That just means that all those weird, like, this is a crazy bug that requires these, like, five insane things to all happen at the same time will probably only happen, like, to one in 10,000 chance of this happening. It's like, oh, well, when you have a lot of people playing the game.
Now it's happening a lot.
All of those people who would happen to just send you an email and be like, my game doesn't work, we have to go, we are very sorry.
Yeah, the other, you know, big indie release of the last few weeks, The Witness. I followed Jonathan Blow on Twitter, and for the couple of days after The Witness released, he was all like, does anyone have, like, this video card in San Francisco and would be willing to drive it over to our offices so we can figure out what the hell is going on it and, you know, crazy stuff like that?
Yeah. Fortunately for us, Unity has had to, they had to carry the weight of most of that particular madness, but there are certainly other things where it's like, you know, someone's like, oh, I try to play the game, but constantly the controls just pulled to the left, and we're like, okay, well, are you sure your joystick was centered when you turned on the game? They're like, yeah, it was. And we're like, you don't have anything else plugged into your game? They're like, no, just this one gamepad. It's like, that's really weird. Okay, so we go back like three or more, like four, like support exchange, and finally they're like, oh, well, I unplugged the steering wheel peripheral from my computer, and now it's fine. It's just like, I'm glad you got it figured out, buddy. Would have been nice to know that at the start.
I had a weird bug, you know, not to like turn this into a bug reporting session or anything, but the strange bug that I had in my playthrough is that I just had one mission objective stuck on the map screen for the entire game.
Yep. That word, the next update we push is going to take care of that. That's just like a weird, stupid load order plus data getting serialized out. And sometimes if one thing happens too fast,
race conditions, yay.
Yeah, exactly that, right? Where it's like, we can't reliably reproduce it. It's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, during all the QA, like, maybe someone would see it once, like, once every 4 to 6 weeks. And we're just like, and sometimes those were like legitimate content bugs where it's just like, oh, you know, the event that this line of dialogue is supposed to clear the quest. It's like, oh, there's like a weird path out of that conversation that doesn't take care of that issue, that doesn't mark that objective as completed. Okay, so we found it, we fixed it, we thought we fixed it, but then it's like, oh no, there's actual, this way more rare, impossible to reproduce, other bug that is systemic, but just kind of invisible, and then, yeah. But we finally got a much more ham-fisted, but thorough way to have those fixed.
The thing that surprised me about this one particularly is I noticed it, like early on, and I was like, oh, okay, well, if I if I reload or something, it'll probably fix itself, or eventually it's just going to go away when a new mission gets triggered. But it was literally like, think the second or third mission objective in the game, like it was going down, it was coming back from going down to the lake, and it never went away. Like no other trigger point cleared it. I even had to quit and restart once because the game like froze up on something else and just reloaded for my last save. And it's still like it was.
Oh, it, weird.
Once I got that mission objective, it was like, nope, that's your mission for the whole rest of the game. But it didn't actually, like, I always felt like I knew what I was doing enough that it never.
Well, the great thing about Steam and compared to the world that Nigel and I have been recently spending a lot of time in is the App Store. On Steam, you can just like find a fix and then release the fix.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Oh my God. It is very nice. It is very nice to make a game on a computer.
Yeah. Cable said something like on the day of releases, like we've already released 2 Steam patches and it's like on the App Store, you know, if you're lucky and the first one gets approved, then you can have 1 week turnaround. And,
yeah. That's like, you know, about what it is for most console-y stuff too. I mean, which is fine. It's obviously a different, it's a different environment, but yeah, the, it's like someone's got a problem. We can just be like, update. Oh, now it's fine. Yes. That is pretty good.
Yeah. Had a chance to play any other games, either, you know, leading up to or since the...
Oh, God, not leading up to. Leading up to, no. Now, finally, well, I mean, I'm still dealing with stuff. But when things finally taper off, maybe in a few more days, I need to figure out if I'm going to sit down and really jam on Darkest Dungeon or Witness. I'm not sure which.
Well, I've played Darkest Dungeon and Nigel's played Witness, so in between the two of us, maybe we have a complete picture to advise you on your predicament.
I kind of feel like Witness is one of those games that anyone working in game development kind of has to play. Like, it really is. It's such a specific, like, complete exploration of a game space that it's kind of amazing. Like, it is really sort of a masterpiece in some respects.
Yeah, I've played several hours of both.
It's so different from most other games. Like, you know, this sort of obsessive focus on, like, the single puzzle schematic and, you know, basically no, like, tutorialing at all. I found it kind of an interesting counterpoint to Firewatch because, like, the two games have, I wouldn't even say, no, I think they do have very similar art styles in some respect, that they're both going for this sort of painted look, and both of them, I think, represent kind of peaks of their respective genres to some degree right now, but in just, like, totally opposite ways. The Witness is just, like, 100% gameplay, and Firewatch is just like 100% narrative.
Yeah.
And it's definitely, I basically played them back to back and thought that, you know, it's maybe the most interesting pair of games that I've played back to back in like my whole career as a gamer.
Hmm. Well, maybe that's my next game then. I can do Firewatch to Witness and you did Witness to Firewatch.
You have to like puzzle games though. Like ultimately, if you don't like puzzle games to some degree, like, you're going to get fed up with it pretty quickly. Like there's nothing else there. It's not it's not an experience that you're going to enjoy the narrative of if you don't like doing the puzzles.
Yeah. I only had a chance to play about an hour, about maybe an hour and a half, but that was definitely the impression I got. I mean, also it feels like it's a thing that you can kind of just dip into a little bit, like, you know, half hour to an hour.
It's dangerous, though, to dip into it.
That's true. I mean, a half hour to an hour, like, a few times a week, just kind of periodically.
Yeah, you definitely don't need... It's not something like Firewatch that you're really rewarded by playing in one sitting. It would be very difficult to play in one sitting. What is dangerous with it is taking too long of a break because... Yeah. I'm sure you've encountered the problem before of, like, forgetting how to play a game, right? Where you'll play a game and like leave it for a while because it's not really working and come back to it later. And you're like, how does anything work? And like, what do these buttons do? You get that like a million fold with the Witness because there's various areas that explore, you know, particular new puzzle mechanisms, but they also build on each other to some degree. Of like, some of the areas will have, you know, things from other areas that you also need to know to complete those areas. And if you forget how any of the mechanics work, you're like done. Hose. Like, you could just, right. You could just get totally stuck. And I sort of had that happen to me. If I played through to like the end game, but I've only done, I think, like half or maybe 2/3 of the puzzles. And then I took a break and played Firewatch and started on the Uncharted stuff, which is the other thing I've been playing recently. And then I was like, oh, I'll go back and try and do some of the puzzles. And I like immediately ran across a puzzle that I was like, the hell does that symbol do? Can't remember anymore. And I had to go and like find that puzzle sequence in the world and like reteach myself the mechanic for one of the puzzle pieces to like remember how it worked.
Oof.
Yeah, I definitely, I've very much enjoyed some puzzle games in the past, but I'm not a beater of puzzle games. I will play them until they get stuck and they make me feel dumb. And then I'll be like, well, I am glad to have played you puzzle game. And so it really comes down to, will I experience this? You know, not that I ever begrudge them for making me feel dumb. That's what puzzle games are supposed to do. And I should be a grown adult and just play through it and become a better person. But instead, I just be annoyed. But if I can get far enough into it that I feel like I've explored and, you know, gotten the sense of the game, I feel like that's a worthy thing to do.
Yeah, totally. I generally don't play a ton of puzzle games, but the ones I do, I will usually like go all in on. The question is, yeah, I think that probably one day I will finish The Witness. A buddy of mine actually here in Vancouver. Do you guys know Nick Vonders?
I adjacently know Nick.
Yeah.
I've talked to him.
Right. He's one of the main dudes. It's like he finished all of The Witness. So I know that if I like get really, 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 truly, impossibly stuck, I could probably ask him for like a vague winking hint without having to like just be the total lame man and just look it up. I never would, but knowing that I don't have to be tempted by that because I can get a human being's vague hinting is comforting.
Yeah, well, you can do it with some insight then, as opposed to just the webpage that says do this thing. Maybe yeah. Sort of like, have you been to the area where you learn this thing? And you're like, yes, I have. I think I know. Okay, no, don't tell me anymore.
Yeah, you know, totally. Sometimes you just need that little tiny bump to just to get those synapses in your brain to just connect correctly.
Yeah, the thing that really gets me and the reason why I end up sometimes looking up things that end up either spoiling something or whatever is that I get really frustrated if I start to get the sense that I might not be able to complete the thing at all. If it's just like I'm trying to force my way through a puzzle that I have yet to learn because I'm not doing them in the right order or something like that. Or
The Witness is, I would say, scrupulously fair in that respect, in that there's, you know, like however many it is, 8 or 10 different symbols that sort of determine how the puzzles work that are all easily identifiable. And you basically, there's no way that you can encounter a puzzle that you don't know how to solve, but you don't know that you don't know how to solve.
And right, so you actually, immediately know.
It's actually fairly easy if you do encounter something that you don't know yet to figure out where you need to go in the world to figure it out.
Okay.
So it you definitely are not going to have that problem with The Witness. Like if you get stuck, it will just be because you can't have the leap of, you know, of sort of insight into the solution to a particular puzzle in the sequence. And even there, I mean, it's way better than most puzzle games are because everything kind of builds really logically on the previous stuff. You'll do, you know, in one of the areas, you'll do like 30 or 40 puzzles in a row based on the same mechanic. And the early ones are just trivial of, you know, usually the first puzzle or two you can solve without even actually knowing how any of the symbols work. And, you know, it builds up very gradually to the point where once you get to the hard ones, you usually can make the leap given enough time to think about it. Like, it's definitely, and I think John Blow has even talked about this, about, you know, that sort of modeling that epiphany state was kind of one of his design goals for the game. And it definitely works.
I just realized I totally forgot to mention something about Firewatch, even though there's probably anything to ask about it, but how about that soundtrack?
Oh, man.
That's awesome. I just loved that, the soundtrack. I just, like, stuck in my head.
Yeah, bloody Remo knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. I don't remember who it was, but someone, and I need to ask Chris if this is actually a conscious decision or a subconscious thing, or if maybe he doesn't even think it's accurate at all. But someone made a quip that it was kind of reminiscent, especially the more synthy tracks. Like, there are some that are obviously very, like, you know, string guitars, but the ones that are a bit more synthy, said that it kind of was reminiscent of Angelo Badalamenti's score from Twin Peaks. And I know Chris loves Twin Peaks, especially the music. So I wonder if that was kind of like a conscious or unconscious point of reference when he was doing the score.
It also gives it that nice kind of 80s vibe to have the music be a little more synthy. Like, it, I mean, although the movie's, you know, very clearly set in the 80s, it's not really a very 80s piece, you know? Like, it's not something like, you know, like a Bioshock or something where it's like, okay, yeah, this is clearly like Art Deco style everywhere and like very much of the time. Like, I mean, there, you know, there aren't any real reasons why you couldn't have that exact same game set in the 70s or the 90s or the 2000 without really any changes. But
well, there's always this thing of communication. Like, that's part of why Gone Home was set in like 1995 or whatever. It's like, if you can just cell phone out or like whatever, then a lot of games become harder. Narrative games become harder because miscommunication and lack of communication and isolation are all super powerful.
Though I think this devices. Like this game it has even more outs in that than most games do, right? That in Gone Home, for example, it would be like set today, it would be absolutely ludicrous that, you know, the sisters weren't texting each other every little detail of their life every moment of the day, right? If they were modern like teenagers and young adults. Whereas probably still if you're a like forest ranger in a national park, you don't get very good cell service on a job site, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's definitely, like, that's a problem, but it's way less of a problem for Firewatch than I feel like it would be for some other games with narrative structure. But yeah, definitely cell phones kind of ruin everything when it comes to art.
Yes. Yeah, even though, I mean, obviously maybe not obviously, Firewatch is deliberately in 89 because in 88 there were a humongous series of wildfires in Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah.
Which is just adjacent to the Shoshone National Forest where the game takes place. So it's kind of like, oh, well, after the giant fires in the park, the government did what it does best and is now reactively staffing up a bunch of unused towers. Previously had been unused. But yeah, the fact that we did not have to do the can't get any reception moment was very alleviating.
Yeah, that's nice.